Hi, I'm Michael Feinstein. My guests today form one of the most dynamic duos in the classical music world, violinist Joshua Bell and pianist Jeremy Denk. They've been performing together off and on for the past 7 years, and their latest project is an album called French Impressions, which features the music of César Franck, Maurice Ravel, and Camille Saint-Saëns. Both of these highly acclaimed musicians have voracious appetites for a wide variety of music, from classical pieces to pop and standards. I can't wait to hear what they have in store for today. Joshua Bell and Jeremy Denk, welcome to Song Travels.
Thank you.
Great
to be here.
So the first obvious question is, how did you gentlemen come to collaborate? That was a look that I have to acknowledge.
I was thinking about the dynamic duo thing. I was trying to figure out which one of us is Batman and which one
has
of
the
us
cape
is
Robin.
I think we trade off.
We do trade off. we first met...
Spoleto, right?
In Charleston, South Carolina, at the Spoleto Festival, we did something together in a sort of reunion concert. But I certainly had heard about Jeremy for many, many years, many great things. We went to the same university, just not quite at the same time.
Indiana, right. Yes. Indiana University, yeah.
And Joshua's mother was there also. Oh, she
yes,
knew me.
He's still there. And she kept saying, "You got to play with Jeremy Denk. He's the best. He's the best." And so finally we had a chance to play together at Spoleto. And then this was about 7 or 8 years ago. And then we've been playing together since, you know, whenever we can. And this is our first full album together, French Impressions.
With all of the... interest you have in so many different styles and genres, how did you come to decide on the French Impressionists for this recording?
These are pieces, at least the way I feel with recordings, I wait until the time where I feel, you know, it's kind of settled into something somewhat stable. I mean, obviously it changes every time we play together, especially with Jeremy. You know, he's always thinking and challenging and not exactly. But
in performance?
Even in performance, on stage, that's one of the things I love about playing with Jeremy is that although we've rehearsed and argued and talked it to death in rehearsal, when you get on stage, you don't know what's going to happen. There's always, and in this kind of music, there is so much room for spontaneity but when it comes to recording, I think we've finally got to a point where I think I've been playing the Franck since I was 13 years old. You know, that's 30 years, and I finally felt, for me personally, I felt it was about time to at least put it down on disc. And
did you record it previously?
I did that one. I did record. That was the only one I did record once before, and that was 20 years ago. And I actually haven't heard it in 20 years.
Are you afraid of listening to it?
Listening to one's old recordings can be a painful process.
Well, Frank Sinatra often re-recorded songs through the years because he felt his ability to do them had deepened. Streisand tried to suppress all of her early recordings, just tried to have them taken off the market. I don't want anybody to ever hear these again. And then a friend reminded her that those were the records that made her famous. So then she relented. But I don't like to listen to early things that I've done.
Well, and these days you can't erase anything anymore. I mean, every rehearsal ends up on YouTube, and there's no more erasing, which is scary.
It's dangerous.
Right. Would you gentlemen play something for us from the new recording?
Sure. Well, the most beloved... it's certainly one of the most popular piece on the album is the Franck Sonata. It's and it was written for the great violinist Isaïe, who was sort of my idol growing up because he was the teacher of my teacher Joseph Gingold, which is kind of awesome because this piece was written in 1880 something, and yet it was written for someone that I was connected with just through one teacher, you know. It's kind of neat, and so I grew up just revering Isaïe and the Franck Sonata. And should we play the second movement? The second is the tumultuous one. We'll give it a try.
Angsty.
Yes. Angsty, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was absolutely wonderful, and of course that's one of the iconic pieces of violin and piano literature. When I hear that movement, I always think of the cliche waves on a shore sort of thing. Do you get pictures, either of you, pictures, images, specific images that you connect with the music?
I'm probably not a very pictorial. I'm more of a, I think of stories a little bit more.
You're more of a blogger.
I'm more of a, yeah, I guess, right. But...
Yeah, I also don't... While I'm playing, I'm not thinking. I sometimes use pictures when I'm studying a piece and thinking about a piece, and it can help inspire. But I'm also not that visual. Stories, I think, are fun for inspiring and getting you in the right idea, but I don't think it needs to be literally spelled out all the way through. I don't know.
Sure. I mean, this piece is very much a romantic epic, but without words, right? So the words are... sort of the recurring themes and who are characters, in a way, protagonists, and a kind of struggle between... I think there is a feeling of good versus evil in this piece, or some sort of... or you know, temptation, or...
Which is interesting, because it was written as a wedding present for Isai. Apparently it was written as his wedding present, so I don't know what that means exactly.
One of the things that I love about this era of classical music is the extraordinary use of melody and the harmonic palette to support the different melodies. And of course, it's interesting to note how many pop songs came from classical themes. They always waited till the guys were long dead, and then they would, you know, rip them off. But do you think of other pieces of music, or do you think of pop songs, or do you think of other connections when you're playing this music?
Certainly, when you listen to or play Ravel, you sometimes think... I often think of Gershwin, of course, and think of other works of Ravel, obviously, that we've come to know. It's fun to see the connections between those. But certainly, particularly in the sonata, there's the blues slow movement that is very much inspired by jazz and perhaps Gershwin directly. I don't know exactly the history of that, but... Mm-hmm. I don't think of pop songs that often when I'm playing some of these.
Well, I didn't mean when you were playing, but I think I was thinking that sometimes you hear a theme, and there's a melodic theme that is something that could be just as popular today in a contemporary song.
Absolutely.
You hear a melody.
This is true. Of course. This happens, and I've thought to myself often listening to some classical works, I think, you know what, I think I want to make a couple $1 million and turn that into a pop song.
Right.
because there's some great songs I think would work, and obviously they've done that already for some, but there's still a lot of untapped potential there.
There's a lot there.
Stealing from Schubert, from a lot of great stuff.
Well, I'd like to actually sing a song that is taken from a Ravel theme.
Oh, great.
I think the first piece of music that brought Ravel to prominence was Pavane for Dead Princess, and in 1938, the year after Ravel and Gershwin's death, Peter DeRose created a pop song based on one of the themes. And the thing that's interesting is that it's just a tiny phrase. It's not the main theme of the piece, but just this little tiny phrase that's played once or twice in the Pavane, and he turned it into a thing called The Lamp is Low. So I'd like to bring the show down to lowbrow and sing it.
Great.
Fantastic.
Beside me in the midnight glow, the lamp is low. the shadows come and go. The lamp is low. My lips will sigh, I love you so. Dream, the sweetest dream we'll ever know. Tonight the moon is high, the lamp is low.
Thank you. The thing I love about that song is that it really does sound impressionistic in a way that pop music was not approaching in that era. But there is that lineage with pop music and Ravel and Gershwin. And Gershwin went to Paris in 1928, and he met Ravel. And there's a famous story that he wanted to study with Ravel, but Ravel basically said, why become a second-rate a Ravel when you can be a first-rate Gershwin?
Right.
and that's the thing, is that Gershwin in 1928 was such a star that he met all of the musical heads of that time. He met Tansman, and Vernon Duke was with him, and he met Alban Berg.
Wow.
And Berg wanted to hear all of these Gershwin songs.
Right.
And Gershwin finally said, why do you want to hear my 32-bar songs when you're writing this extraordinary complex music? And Berg said something that, Joshua, I've heard and read that you've said a number of times. He said, my dear Mr. Gershwin, music is music. And so when I hear Ravel, I think of the great influences of Gershwin. Do you feel there's a connection between Ravel and Gershwin musically?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's very hard to say what influenced what, who influenced who at that time, right? Because it's all kind of frothing up, or it's kind of interconnected. But I definitely feel, you know, when you hear like the early jazz and you hear late 19th century like classical harmony, like even Wagner or Debussy, Ravel, all that stuff, where they're pushing the limits of what used to be the harmonic language, and you hear jazz, and a lot of the vocabulary is very similar, right? The kinds of harmonies, the kind of things that they do. And there is like a wonderful dovetailing of this American art form and the sort of high end of the sort of late crash of European art form. It's very interesting.
And Ravel was so amazingly facile, I guess you'd say, at using other language or getting at the essence of some other languages and infusing it with his own. I mean, just in the violin repertoire, we have their Tzigan, which is the famous gypsy piece, which is, I mean, he just captures that gypsy flair, and yet it's so Ravel as well. And that's the same with this blues movement of you hear, oh, that's jazz, right? And then, but it's so much his own language as well. It's a brilliant movement, actually. It's a mashup of all these things. You always know that Ravel is there. He's not copying anybody.
So would you please play the Gershwin-influenced blues movement of the Ravel Sonata?
Love to.
Thank you.
That was the extraordinary blues movement by Ravel from his Sonata for Violin and Piano. Amazing. It makes me want to know everything about Ravel when I hear that music, because it is so compelling and so mysterious and beautiful.
He's a consummate craftsman, Ravel.
He's just, just amazing composer.
Well, this whole connection is fascinating to me, of Gershwin and Ravel and that jazz era. The Gershwin repertoire at one time was so unacceptable in the concert hall. It was so second rate in the opinions of the critics. And now we have a time where Gershwin is very well accepted. But both of you in different ways have pushed the musical boundaries. And I wanted to ask if there are consequences for not falling into the norm of what people expect a concert artist should do.
Well, we're back to music is music, because yeah. I really hate when people separate into sort of lowbrow music or Hoch music as being the great music, and the Gershwin and Bernstein or even Saint-Saëns, which is, I think, a masterpiece. The piece we play on our disc and his music in general is often thought of as light and lesser music, and it just bothers me so much because it's they're each their own worlds, and Porgy and Bess is one of the great operas that was ever written, I think, and his music deserves to be played alongside Schubert and Mozart.
I agree, of course. And actually, both of you are continuing traditions that are sort of forgotten, that especially violinists like Fritz Kreisler and even Heifetz, they all played popular music in one way or another, or music that was not pigeonholed in a certain way. Jeremy, with piano works, of course, you play a lot of contemporary literature.
I sure do, yeah.
And what is the reaction when you mix something like that with standard repertoire? Are people accepting of that more these days?
I think they are. I think there's a general uprising of kind of more quirky and unusual classical programming, because for a long time it's been a sort of certain way. And then, I think there's a lot of, especially the young contemporary classical composers, whatever that means, a lot of them are trying to incorporate the language of popular music into their and to blur the boundary between what is considered high and low, because that's the way it's always been.
And that's what they grew up with. It's what's horrible is when a composer tries to somehow artificially pluck out some kind of language that's unique, but not actually coming from his own experience and his own world. And we live in an era with popular music, and if it's incorporated, that seems to be the most natural thing.
I mean, like one of the most arduous, hardcore contemporary composers just passed away, Ligeti, Georgi Ligeti.
Mm. Well, I know him from 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's
right.
When I first came
to Ligeti. Sure. And he's an amazing composer, and I played a lot of his piano etudes, which are like the most difficult pieces possibly ever. But a lot of them are Bill Evans refracted through, or Thelonious Monk, or whatever. It's a lot of great jazz piano thinking and fused with other things, and that's wonderful music.
I agree, of course. There's more coming up in a moment with violinist Joshua Bell and pianist Jeremy Denk. Our program is made possible in part by NPR and the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks. I'm Michael Feinstein, and this is Song Travels from NPR Music. Joshua, you've had a lot of connections with Hollywood, with doing work for films, film scoring. Mm-hmm. And I remember that your Gershwin Fantasy recording, one of the pieces was orchestrated by Alexander Courage, who was one of the great legendary Hollywood arrangers.
That's true. Who
is one of my heroes, actually.
He's an amazing guy. And he wrote Star Trek, didn't he?
Yes, he wrote the Star Trek theme, which brought him a lot of money late in his life. Mm-hmm. But he was one of those guys that did all those MGM musicals and was connected to a whole era that's very important to
me. He's the one that came to me first with this Porgy and Bess.
Courage did?
Yeah. Wow. With his fantasy that he had was sort of a rough version. And then the fun part was working with him to kind of make it into a piece that I felt worked for the violin and orchestra, and added my own little cadenza and stuff like that.
Well, the great thing about the composers of the 20th century is that they had a certain technology that didn't exist earlier. And Gershwin made piano rolls. He made over 125 of them, and of course I know you know that because you worked with Gershwin.
I did. I had very fortunate to have worked with him.
How was he?
Well, thanks to technology, Bill Braun and I worked on some arrangements, and we put together a suite and lowdown, and he had the idea of including the piano roll of Gershwin himself playing the tune. So at the end he modulates into the key that the piano roll is in, and I play along with him, and we kind of end the song together, which is a lot of fun. So yeah, technology can be fun. It's not always necessary. My violin is 300 years old, made by Stradivarius, and nothing has been made that's better than that today. But there's certainly a lot to be done with technology too.
Let's hear you play with Gershwin.
Oh, great! Wonderful. Thank you.
Sweet and Low Down, you performing with Gershwin thanks to a piano role he made in 1925.
Yeah, I was able to do it in concert as well a couple of times, where we had the piano and you see the keys moving. It's kind of creepy because it really is him, and you feel like you're playing. Actually, one time I did it, it malfunctioned and he didn't come in. But,
those temperamental artists. Well, you know, there are a lot of roles that were made, piano roles that were made just as accompaniment for violinists. I have
Music Minus One.
A bunch of them. Yeah, I have a bunch of them that came from the estate of an MGM musical director. Mm. So there's a whole bunch of legendary pianists that are waiting to play with you.
Huh? My God, I sense a new album.
Could be. No one's done it. It could be a great album. Well, after George Gershwin wrote An American in Paris, he actually, for Broadway, a year later, created a popular song out of the famous homesickness theme from the work, which I think might be a unique example of a composer taking a concert work, a concert piece, and specifically creating a popular song from it a year after he wrote the symphonic work. Right. I'd actually like to sing that for you now, if I may.
Oh, great.
Wonderful.
An American in Paris on a holiday. An American in Paris, just a boy at play. Mid the magic of the city, mid the scene so gay, he hears a voice a-calling over the sea, the voice of homeland saying, come back to me. It haunts him, his thoughts go flying. It haunts him, his lonely heart is sighing. Sunshine learned to shine. Home, a place that love has made divine. So my eyes are turning to where I left this yearning heart of mine. Thank you. wondering boys coming home.
Gorgeous.
Nice.
Thank you. Well, it's an easy leap to go from Gershwin to Debussy, because Gershwin loved Debussy. One of the things he brought back from his Paris trip in 1928 were the then sometimes hard to find editions of Debussy. Uh-huh. So, Jeremy, would you kindly play something by Debussy?
Sure, my pleasure.
What might that be?
Well, I think the most appropriate would be the prelude, one of the preludes called Minstrels, in which he's clearly evoking and having fun with the minstrelish tradition of music making.
Sounds politically incorrect.
I think it is a little politically incorrect, yeah. But wonderfully witty and French also at the same time.
Please. That was wonderful.
Proud Thank of you, Jeremy.
I love the, as you say, the wit in the music, and when we hear it now, I think of the context of the time in which he wrote that piece. It was so extraordinary, so unlike anything that anybody had heard before. Do you know what the reaction was when he first was writing that and the other preludes?
Debussy's music certainly did have some shock value, because he unwound what sort of many important conventions of harmony, especially, and he sort of wandered into a sort of uncharted territory deliberately with the whole tones and, you know, sort of going. But this piece is, I think the main thing is this great love affair between the French culture at that time and this American sort of underground art form that was, and this kind of wonderful attraction that they had, a kind mm-hmm. of attraction of opposites in a weird way.
Mm-hmm. Do either of you compose?
I aspire to be a composer. I do write all my own cadenzas for all the major. I even replaced Mendelssohn's for the Mendelssohn.
Wow.
I did dare to do that.
Did you hear from his attorney?
But with the idea that, you know, in Mendelssohn's time, look, Mendelssohn wrote piano parts to the Bach Chaconne and in the solo Bach stuff. So clearly, music was something that one was allowed to fool around with, and Mendelssohn might not like my cadenza, but I think he might have approved of in concept. If I felt compelled to do it, why not do it?
I agree. I think that absolutely it's necessary to keep finding new things to contribute to the classics in a way that keeps people on their toes. And I know that's not why you do it, but the idea of creating a cadenza is, as you say, part of a tradition that was commonplace with transcriptions for every conceivable instrument of any popular piece of music. Well, we're going to bookend this program by ending with another movement of the Franck Sonata, which is, of course, featured on your new recording, French Impressions. Which movement are you going to play to close the program?
How about the last? That would make sense.
I think it would make the most sense. Yeah.
This whole piece is such a journey, and this last movement is where you'd say that I guess the sun sort of starts to come out, and he ends the whole thing with this in a glorious way, brings back themes from earlier, and just ties everything together in such an amazing way. Interesting thing about this movement is that we don't. We play the same tune, but not at the same time.
Right. It's what we call a canon, yeah. Constantly staggered back and forth, tossing the idea kind of ever more ecstatically, right?
Yes.
Back and forth from one to the other.
You sure it's not a typography error?
That would be a really boring piece, by the way.
We should try it once.
We should try
it.
Yeah.
Fix it and play it at the same time.
Well, let's hear it.
All right. Thank you.
thank you both for sharing this time on Song Travels, and wish you the very best with this recording.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. It's been fun.
Really fun.
Me too.
You've been listening to Song Travels with host Michael Feinstein and his guest, pianist Jeremy Dink and violinist Joshua Bell. Song Travels is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio and is recorded at Hearst Studios in New York City, with post-production in the Elaine T. Friedman Suite at ETV Radio in Columbia, South Carolina. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Duke Marcos, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production manager Grant Jackson. The executive producer is Kobe Hennessy. The executive in charge is Linda O'Brien. You can find out more about the artists and music on this series by visiting our website, scetv.org/songtravels. Support for Song Travels comes from NPR and the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and NPR. Contributors include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.